Since Moshe mentioned my recent appointment to the SEC, I guess for the first time I should state the customary disclaimer that what you're about to hear does not reflect dot dot dot, and I think you can fill in it does not reflect the views of the commission, et cetera, et cetera. I think you've probably heard that before. The paper. My presentation, in fact, is in your booklet, and if you're interested in the specific paper with this title, it also can be downloaded at the link that's here. And more generally, my papers on asset allocation and taxes are all available on my web page, which is at this link. And in fact, my talk today. The second half of my talk will be based upon this paper. The first half will be somewhat more introductory and based upon earlier work that we did, which was focused upon a single risky asset. But I want to sort of begin with that to orient you to the model framework and some of the more basic issues. And in particular, that paper, So the single risky asset paper, there our main paper was in the Review of Financial Studies in 2001, but some of the examples that I'll be presenting will be based upon an expositional version of that that we published under the TIA CREF cover last year, and all of those papers are. This is just the last page of my presentation slides. So if you're interested in any of these papers, you can download them at the appropriate links. As perhaps some of you may remember, this is my second opportunity to speak at the Personal Financial Management Conference. I also spoke at last year's conference, and my theme there was to focus upon the impact of asset location, and in fact, there were some references to that work in the discussion of one of the papers earlier in the session today. Today, the environment that I'm going to focus on, however, does not deal with the location issues, that is, the tax-deferred versus the taxable account. My focus here will be only on the taxable account, and I want to sort of say that at the onset. And the in the absence of taxes and other trading costs, of course, investors would rebalance their portfolios frequently, maybe perhaps even continuously, to benefit from the optimal risk-return trade-off. Of course, taxes are an extremely important friction for asset allocation, and I would argue perhaps the most important friction for asset allocation for a taxable investor. Yet, most of the traditional models of asset allocation completely ignore tax considerations. And tax considerations, in fact, I think are somewhat subtle because of the nature of how capital gains taxes work. Specifically, capital gains taxes are triggered by sale. So the investor's selling decision, which in effect is his rebalancing decision or selling decision, is endogenous, but it's going to be influenced greatly by the presence of the capital gains taxes. So in fact, the tax environment, so it's not simply an issue to treat taxes properly. It's not simply an issue of focusing upon after-tax returns. If the tax system was a mark-to-market or accrual-based tax system, we could simply take our standard asset allocation models and substitute in for pre-tax returns, substitute in the corresponding after-tax returns. However, because the tax system doesn't work that way, because the tax is triggered by realization, we can't do that. That is, in practice, the sale of an asset triggers a capital gain or loss for tax purposes. But capital gains taxes, on the other hand, are deferred until the asset is sold. And in fact, within the United States context, they're actually forgiven at death. And I'll come back to the Canadian context later in my talk. So the issue that we want to address is what's the trade-off between portfolio rebalancing / diversification on the one hand and payment of capital gains taxes on the other. How does the trade-off vary with the investor's situation? And within the context of our model, what I mean by the investor's situation is his portfolio structure, extent of gains, and age. Our aim here is to challenge conventional perspective and rules of thumb on many of the facets of portfolio rebalancing. So the basic problem that we're going to set up will be an expected utility maximization problem of an investor who basically has a bunch of financial wealth We're going to put aside the issue of labor income. We're just going to give them some financial wealth, and the investor is going to make an optimal consumption choice over time and solve for his optimal portfolio at every period. Now, just to focus up upon the specific parameterization that will sort of underlie our numerical solutions, we're going to basically focus on annual decisions by such an investor starting at age 20, basically going out for up to 80 years, so all the way through age 100. We use an observed mortality curve. Underlying our model is an observed mortality curve. That's sort of the main linkage between our framework and the broader theme of the conference involving mortality. But as you'll see, I think asset allocation issues here are going to be intertwined with mortality, particularly through the role of reset of capital gains bases at the investor's death. We specifically assume that our investor has constant relative risk aversion. Now, in fact, coefficient of risk aversion we take to be 3 for our numerical solutions. More specifically, we also, in effect, what is implicit in this is that coefficient is also, it's 3, and so specific. So in fact, that means it's constant over time. So our coefficient of, we have a coefficient of relative risk of risk aversion, which is constant in the sense that we have power utility with gamma 3. But in addition, that coefficient is staying constant over time. Now, I highlight that point to you because in many of the presentations throughout the day, the issue has one of the issues of focus has been how do asset allocations change over the life cycle. The view that we take about this is to be sort of agnostic about the baseline asset allocation issue. We take the coefficient of risk aversion to be constant over time, intertemporal. We take it to be constant over the lifetime. So in effect, in our setting, the traditional Merton-Samuelson result that was sort of referred to a number of points today, that the mix is constant between equity and bonds over time, that would certainly prevail in our environment. The reason I want to sort of impose that, well, first of all, in fact, our framework, if you have time-varying coefficient, but within the class of constant relative risk-averse preferences at each point in time, our technique and our approach works fine. But I think as a baseline, it's a more convenient baseline to assume a constant coefficient over time, because therefore, to the extent that there are aging effects, to the extent that there are time-dependent effects, you can see how those are related to tax considerations. At death, the investor's portfolio is liquidated without payment of any gains taxes, and the proceeds are used to provide a bequest to the investor's beneficiary. In effect, at death, there's forgiveness of capital gains taxes consistent with the reset provision in the United States tax code. In effect, what that means is that the basis of the investor is marked up to the current market value at the time of death. In effect, the capital gains tax liability goes away at death. So if the elderly person can hold on to his appreciated asset until he dies, capital gains tax is gone. Clearly, that's going to create some incentives with respect to the portfolio structure as one's age and mortality risk changes. No, but with respect to estate taxes, so the capital gains taxes are distinct from estate taxes. Estate taxes, however, can be viewed as proportional on the total value of the estate. So as a result, with respect to the issues that we're focusing on today, in a sense, the estate tax is non-distortionary. Or another way to say it is, suppose the estate tax is simply a proportional tax, then the government owns a piece of your estate, and you own a piece of your estate, and then basically the analysis essentially goes through. So the distortionary issues with respect to asset allocation, I would argue, are primarily associated with the capital gains tax, which is what we focus on. We ignore the estate tax for this analysis. Well, that's a scale, but that's sort of more like a scale issue. Now, we have a paper. We have a paper that was recently accepted for the American Finance Association program, and that I list on our reference list, which deals with some estate planning issues. We focus, in fact, on both issues of asset titling and other location issues that are sort of related to the spirit of this. But that's not the direction I'm going to go today. So to solve these problems is actually a little bit of a bear numerically. these models of lifetime, so we've set up basically a model of lifetime portfolio allocation. But unfortunately, these models suffer from the in effect, the curse of dimensionality, which, you know, arises in a lot of numerical contexts. In particular, basically, the higher the dimensionality of the state space, you know, the more complicated the problem becomes, and in fact, it pretty quickly becomes intractable. We can basically get numerical solutions at this point only up to two risky assets. Each risky asset basically requires us to introduce at least two continuous state variables, and then we also have the investor's age, and basically that's as far as we've been able to push numerically. That also relates a bit to some of the discussion concerning the paper on tax location earlier today. The criticism was raised that, of course, the paper only dealt with two risky assets, and, you know, frankly, I think it's likely to be hard, you know, unless one really comes up with a different numerical approach, and in fact, a kind of a new creative empirical approach, it's going to really be hard to kind of go beyond, I think, two risky assets, at least with current computing technology. So basically, now, given these computational issues, simplifying the model is really going to be crucial to make headway. We're going to assume either that we have one or two risky assets and a riskless asset. We're going to use, and our 2001 paper pioneered this idea, we're going to assume that the investor's base tax basis for computing capital gains taxes is his average basis. The reason we're going to assume that is because if it was based upon the basis of individual shares, we would need to keep track of the whole distribution of the investor's bases and when he acquired shares and the like, and then we would have a very high dimensional problem. However, one of the things that's very nice about the average is you can always update the average by knowing the prior average and taking into account your current decision. So that basically, that really is the crucial, I think, insight in our line of research here, to try to make these problems numerically tractable. You know, and that was one of the, and obviously that was also one of the tricks that was exploited in the presentation earlier today as well. We're going to assume a binomial process. That's more for convenience and concreteness than anything else. That's not really, I think, crucial to the numerical issues. The constant relative risk aversion I want to kind of comment on, that's actually helpful computationally because under constant relative risk averse preferences in our tax environment, like in other problems in asset allocation, basically the decision rules are going to be proportional to wealth. That basically means we really don't need to keep track of wealth, and we can drop wealth out as a state variable. So this particular choice of preferences is really convenient because it allows us to eliminate one other object that would otherwise we would need to have as a state variable, namely keeping track of wealth. We don't have to keep track of wealth with this choice. So we're going to write our problem as a dynamic programming problem and solve it backwards recursively. We're going to take a finite horizon approach to this. Now, in part, we do that because the finite horizon approach worked for us numerically. But in part also because there's additional insights that emerge from a finite horizon treatment, frankly, that we wouldn't get in an infinite horizon treatment. In an infinite horizon treatment, we really wouldn't be able to get interesting age sorts of interpretations and insights about the nature of the reset at death in the way we can, I think, with the finite horizon. So the state variables for our problem become then the investor's holdings of each of the risky assets, his basis to price ratio, again, for each of the assets, and the investor's age. So for each of the assets, we're going to need at least two continuous state variables, a basis to price ratio and a holdings variable. Now, you might say, well, what about the holdings of the risk-free asset? Well, basically, the holdings of the risk-free asset are going to be 1 minus the sum of the holdings of the risky assets, so that we don't need to, and there's obviously no basis issue on those. So for each risky asset, we're going to have two continuous state variables and plus time, in our problem. Now, the model parameters that we're going to assume so I've described some of the preference parameters in the tax treatment. Finally, I should describe to you the conditions in the financial market. So for our illustration, we chose the following parameter values. We have a bond that's basically like a T-bill. It's a one-period riskless bond, constant interest rate of 6%. It's taxed at 36%. We allow borrowing within the framework. We have stock. The stock has a dividend of 2%. The dividend is taxed based upon the old rules in the U.S., so at the full ordinary rate of 36%. And we have a capital gain process. Capital gain follows a binomial. with an expected return of 7 and volatility of 20. So the total return on equity is essentially 9%. Realized capital gains are taxed at 20%, again, the old rate in the U.S. Environment for capital gains. We don't allow short sales. We assume an inflation rate of 3.5%. These parameters are nominal parameters. The reason, you might wonder, well, why don't we just sort of postulate some real parameters and ignore inflation? The reason is because inflation sort of affects the way in which taxation works. And so to just sort of make it a little bit more realistic, that's why, so we sort of pick nominal parameters, but keep in mind that there's this constant inflation rate in the background. The risk premium that we assume is basically just over 3%. Basically, it's the capital gain 1.07 times the dividend 1.02 minus 1 gives us a risk premium of 3.14%. And the mortality rates come from the 2000 U.S. life tables. I noticed at least in one of the other presentations today there was actually reference to also using the 2000 U.S. life tables. Let me say one thing about these life tables. When I looked at these tables, I was sort of amazed. This is a table based upon annuity purchasers. The conditional mortality rate in these tables did not hit 50% until the table runs out at age 115, by the way. But the conditional mortality rate did not reach 50% until the person in the representative agent in the mortality table hit age 109. That up to age 109, the mortality rates were actually less than 50% per year. And clearly, I think what that's suggesting is that annuity purchasers have a fair bit of longevity. I'm sorry? Okay, so within the U.S. you can deduct some losses, but only up to $3,000 a year. We are in effect allowing unlimited. We're in effect allowing unlimited losses in our treatment. I think the alternative way to go would be probably not to allow. So we're allowing unlimited treatment of losses. Now, we don't want to deal with scale issues because of estate variable issues. So I think the only other realistic way we could go is we could simply not allow deductibility of losses. That would also, I think, be consistent. I mean, that's not what we do. That would be an alternative where we wouldn't need an additional estate variable. If we were going to key to a particular level like 3,000, we would then need to be keeping track of wealth and the like. You can carry that forward indefinitely. In fact, indefinitely up until you die. It does not pass through to your heirs, though. So the capital losses get lost at death if you've been carrying them forward. Okay. So that's basically the setup, the numerical parameters. So let me start to present some results, ideas, and et cetera, and some illustrations. And that's basically what I'll do in most of the rest of my talk. So first basic point, the incentive to sell assets with an embedded gain in order to diversify, or for that matter, to consume, is, first of all, inversely related to the size of the gain. That is, the bigger the gain, of course, the less willing you're going to be to sell. And it's going to be inversely related to the investor's age. The older you are, the less willing you're going to be to sell. Why is that? Well, younger investors have the strongest diversification incentive. The old investor, he's got a more limited life expectancy. And furthermore, you might say, well, okay, but his heirs, don't they care about diversification? Yeah, they may care about diversification. But when they get the assets, they're going to have the full reset of the basis. So then they're going to be able to diversify without capital gains costs. Elderly investors, in effect, benefit the most from the reset provision at death. And so one of our results is that they actually hold relatively more equity. Remember, we were otherwise neutral about the aging effect. So this result that they hold relatively more equity, it's driven basically by this capital gains. Now, I also want to point out that there's both ex ante and ex post effects of the reset provision. The traditional argument by tax planners in the United States context is that the elderly, if they have appreciated assets, they should hold on to them and pass them on to the next generation through at death. Our argument goes one step further. That's sort of, I think of it as an ex post argument. But our argument is really going one step further. We're arguing that ex ante, it pays to own relatively more equity if you're elderly than if you're young, because if you're elderly and the asset pops up in price, you're going to potentially be able to pass it along to your heirs tax-free, whereas if it goes down in price, you're going to be able to take the loss. And so, in effect, the terms of trade between bonds and equity are somewhat different as a function of age, and this produces sort of an ex-ante-age effect. That ex-ante-age effect is illustrated in the following plot. The three curves in this plot are, this is just for our baseline parameters, it's plotting the optimal equity proportion as a function of age. The bottom panel is where your basis, what we're calling basis here is really basis to price ratio. When your basis to price ratio is 1, you can fully adjust without paying any current tax. So in that case, as you get on in years, in the retirement years, you start to hold more and more equity because of this trade-off due to the increasing immediacy of the reset of the basis and taking into account the mortality structure. On the other hand, as your basis to price ratio goes down, so in the next curve is where your basis to price ratio is 0.8, and then we're at 0. Now, when the basis to price ratio is 0, that means when you sell the stock, all the proceeds are taxed as capital gain. So that's sort of the most extreme capital gain. In that case, we started for this plot our investor at 50% equity holding. And basically, with a 0 basis, our investor basically stays at 50% holding. Whereas when the basis was 1, so no cost, he adjusts to about a 41% level, and he goes somewhere in between when he's paying his intermediate capital gains tax. Now, another way to slice at this is with our next plot. So it's based upon the same parameter values, but now instead of looking across ages, we focus on a single age, namely age 30. In this case, though, we still consider three basis to price ratios, but now we vary the incoming proportion. And the idea, basically, I think here I want to focus upon the upper curve, the one that sort of looks like it's sort of piecewise linear, going up linearly to about a holding of about 0.6 and then staying flat. The interpretation of this curve is the following. This is the curve corresponding to, again, zero basis. So basically, if you have a position in equity, and it happens to be more than, if your equity happens to be more than about 60%, then basically you scale back to 60% at this age. If your holding is less than 60%, you scale back based upon this linear segment. So, So, actually, if your holding is over 60%, you scale back to 60%. If your holding is in this region, you basically buy and hold. You just hold on to what you have. You don't want to pay the capital gains tax. On the other hand, if the capital gains tax is less because your basis to price ratio is higher, you might potentially then choose to scale back. So basically, you can sort of see how the size of the gain, of course, influences the optimal allocation. Now, finally, with respect to this one risky asset environment, let me consider the role of the reset provision at death in the following way. So, since we're in Canada, although actually we sort of say this in our paper, even though our paper is written, of course, primarily for the United States audience, in Canada, keep in mind that capital gains are in fact taxed at death, as opposed to providing the reset of the basis. So, capital gains are due on the existing appreciation, and then of course the basis is reset to the market value, but you've got to pay up, you've got to pay the tax at that point. And then the question is, how should investors facing such a tax system behave compared to investors in the U.S. context? So in effect, there's mandatory capital gains realization at death. And so clearly then, the deferral option loses some of its value. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but there's still a value to the deferral option because you still get time, you can potentially still be earning time value by pushing back those capital gains. Well, that's true. But nevertheless, the result is that basically investors realize gains, but investors are still going to be more anxious to realize gains than in the U.S. type system, and especially in the later years. In the later years, people are really holding on in the U.S., hoping to get that reset at death. In the Canadian system, all you're going to get is you're going to get time value, and at death, the time value process terminates. So investors are going to be much more anxious under the Canadian system to realize gains before death, because basically the benefit, the tax benefit, is going to be much more muted, and so you're going to be relatively more anxious to maintain much closer to an optimal portfolio. Another way to say this is that the optimal holdings are nearly constant across ages, And I think that's maybe most clearly depicted in the upper panel here, which I again do for three different basis to price ratios, where you see that the holdings now are pretty well constant across age. So that's what I want to basically say about the single risky asset environment. And as I mentioned before, the first two references on the reference list at the back are kind of the most germane there. What I want to now turn to for the remainder of my talk is the case of multiple risky assets, and the relevant background for this is based upon the paper that's sort of the actual title of my talk and the link there that I had there. So the issue here is basically there's a couple of ways to sort of slice this. Broadly what I want to try to get at here is, suppose now there's not just one asset in the portfolio. But in particular, what I want to try to understand is, are there things that I can learn but from introducing a second risky asset that wouldn't have been obvious to me by having one risky asset? I mean, frankly, it doesn't seem to me that if all I'm going to be able to do is introduce a second risky asset, and all I'm going to say is, well, gee, I solved a more complicated numerical problem, well, okay, but I think really our goals are a little bit more ambitious than that. What we'd like to do is we'd like to use the introduction of that second risky asset to tell us things about behavior that we couldn't see from the single risky asset problem, and you'll see our orientation is going to be to do that. So suppose, for example, an investor, one of the examples we're going to take up, in fact, the first of the numerical examples, will be, suppose an investor, in fact, has most of his wealth in a highly appreciated position in a single company stock. To what extent should he diversify despite the capital gains costs? Now, this is actually a pretty realistic case. And it's a pretty realistic case because a lot of people accumulate a lot of their wealth as a byproduct of the company they work with. This is true for entrepreneurs. In fact, our first speaker this morning, you could argue, with such an individual, significant stockholder in a well-known private company. But this is true. You know, this is characteristic for a lot of people. They help build up a business, and they own significant pieces of that business. Even for people who are working for major corporations, these individuals who are working for major corporations, unless they're perhaps the CEO, you might not think of as owning. You might think that they don't own a major piece of the business. But nevertheless, a significant piece of their own wealth is going to often be tied up in the business. I remember a few years ago I was chatting with somebody at Merrill Lynch, and they commented to me that, gee, more than about 35% of all the Merrill Lynch stock is owned by Merrill Lynch employees. Now, clearly Merrill Lynch isn't anywhere near 35% of the worldwide wealth basket, so you kind of know that these folks are going to be way over, relative to traditional benchmarks, these folks are way overexposed to Merrill Lynch relative to, let's say, kind of a CAPM sort of market portfolio type of intuition. Now, there's good incentive reasons, frankly, for that, and but I'm just going to push those issues to the side and focus instead on the issue of so you wind up in a concentrated position. Let's say the incentive issues, they've kind of now evaporated, maybe because now you're retired or you're not engaged in the business in some way, so the incentive issues aren't there. But at this point, you perhaps have had a significant capital gains appreciation. So to what extent are you going to want to diversify given the tax? Do you want to diversify despite the tax? So that's one of the main issues I want to take up. Second kind of issue is, suppose you have positions in different stocks. Let's say, for example, you have a substantial position in Citigroup, and you have another substantial position in J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, these two stocks, they're pretty correlated with each other. Why? Well, because when certain types of loans go bad, these loans tend to be significant pieces of the portfolios of both these lenders. And so, how does the fact that you have the one holding affect your decision with respect to the other holding? And for concreteness, suppose you have a large gain on Citigroup. How does that influence how much you want to sell or whether you want to sell J.P. Morgan Chase if you have a much smaller gain on it? And what I would argue is that under this sort of scenario, you want to sell relatively more of your J.P. assuming that the proportions in the basket were the same, and assuming so therefore your kind of optimal mix was sort of about symmetric, you'd actually want to sell relatively more of the J.P. Morgan Chase position when you had a large gain on the Citigroup. That is, you want to sort of your optimal position with respect to a security should depend upon the basis of other securities in your portfolio. This is sort of part of, I think, the portfolio theoretical lesson from this sort of analysis. what are some of the general features? And so one of the themes I want to sort of take up are what are some of the general features of optimal portfolio rebalancing? So to turn then to my numerical example, the first of my two numerical examples. So this is the one with the concentrated portfolio position. The way we set this example up is that there's two stocks. Think of one as a company stock, individual asset, individual concentrated position, and think of the other as the index. To kind of make that interpretation natural, we're going to give the volatility of the individual stock a sigma of 40%, and the volatility of the index 20%. So this 40% is pretty representative of the volatility of individual stocks. 20% is, as in fact some of the statistics that we were presented with earlier today illustrate, pretty representative of the volatility of the index. We're going to assume on each the same expected returns. Now, part of the reason I want to do that is that'll sort of just simplify how we think about the model, because in fact, then we know if you think about this in mean variance terms, if you fix the total holdings of the two risky assets, basically then you're focusing on a line within mean standard deviation space, and the traditional mean variance objective would just be to minimize the variance given the sum of the holdings of the two risky assets, and just putting aside the issue of what proportion of the asset you have in the risk-free asset. So we've got a capital gain return of 7% on each of the two risky assets. We're going to give the bond a return of 6%. It's basically the same parameters as before. Now we're going to fix the and the dividend yield and inflation will be just like before. Tax rate's also the same as before. The only other wrinkle I need to introduce is what's my correlation between the two assets. I'm going to pick a correlation to be 0.5. The reason in part is I think on the one hand that's pretty representative of the correlation between individual stocks and the index on an annual basis. Another way to say that, though, is if I think about the issue of minimizing the variance when I've got two risky assets with these volatilities, if I pick my correlation to match the ratio of the standard deviations, then my optimal holding of the high variability asset will be exactly equal to zero, and that's a simple calculation to do. That's actually kind of a good master's homework exercise. Actually, it's kind of a nice illustration that even though you would think you want to introduce different assets into a portfolio, if the variabilities are spread out enough relative to the correlation, it doesn't pay to introduce the high variability asset. It doesn't help reduce your overall portfolio variance. So the point, for the purposes of my illustration, the reason I want to do that is I want there to be no diversification reason to hold the concentrated position. So were there not taxes, you'd simply go to hold the index. See, that seems to me to be a sensible baseline for setting up my example. So then what will we learn from the example? And then I'll show you a couple of figures. So a couple of points that we'll learn. The index and so here we've set it up, of course, so the index and the company stock have the same expected return, but different variability, essentially due to the idiosyncratic variability on the company stock. That's basically the maintained structure that we have in mind. And the results are the following. We're going to scale back the holdings of the company stock potentially pretty dramatically, given the opportunity to substitute the market index. This incentive to diversify is really strong. In fact, as you'll see, even it'll get stronger as you get younger because the reset becomes less and less valuable. But even at age 90, the investor sells most of his concentrated exposure immediately. So, you know, this person, he's wound up with most of his wealth being concentrated. He's age 90, so in effect his maybe life expectancy remaining is about 5 years. So you might think, well, gee, the person's going to want to hold on. Well, actually, what the person wants to do is get rid of most of it, because the diversification costs, even over those few years, are so big that they actually more than offset the tax costs. And one way to view this in CAPM terms is, remember that you're getting paid for extra risk. Well, first of all, here you're taking on all this risk that you're not being paid for. Imagine that you could get paid by maybe substituting index and scaling it up. Well, you didn't want to do that anyway. And so here you've got all this risk that you're not being paid for. But the pricing, even in the traditional framework, would only grow linearly. Well, the diversification costs, they're growing nonlinearly. They're growing quadratically, and so they become kind of overwhelmingly, and you kind of want to get rid of most of that. That's basically the intuition. As the gain on the company stock declines, you sell more of it, and purchase more of the index, i.e. you diversify. Interestingly, there's actually there's some cases where you may even decide instead of doing that, you might decide to sell the index if the gains are really small on the index, because that might be the cheapest way to get you to scale back a little bit. And I think that's a little bit surprising, but that has to do with the differences in the basis across the assets. So basically, if you've got a huge gain on the company stock, basically almost no gain on the index, it might be just efficient, even though you'd like to, in principle, make the risk go away or scale it back on the company stock, it might be the cheapest way to start to scale back might be actually to do it on the index, because the tax costs are so slight for getting rid of the index. That obviously depends upon the particular patterns of bases. That last point is so this is a plot for an investor at our last date at age 99. Now, this panel, and we assumed here that the investor starts the period with 90% company stock, 10% index, no bonds. That's where he starts. And then this plot gives us the holding of the company stock. This plot gives us the holding of the index that's optimal coming out of the period. This is the total equity proportion, so 1 minus that is the bond proportion coming out of the period. The main point here that I want to highlight is this little region down here right on this edge. So this is sort of in the area where the index basis is pretty close to 1. So in effect here, the taxes associated with selling the index is very slight. But in this area here, the company basis is real low, so the gains, the tax costs associated with the company stock are really big, because most of your sale of the company stock you're going to have to pay tax on, because you're going to basically pay tax on 1 minus the basis is going to trigger your tax. So in this region here, you actually, what you wind up doing is you start out with 10% by hypothesis. So there's some region where you don't do anything. You hold the index, you may scale back the company stock, but you hold the index. And then there's a region where you start to buy the index over here. But interestingly, over here, what you do is you actually sell the index, but that has to do with the relative tax basis, and I think a little bit of a surprising result. So that's at age 99. Anyway, we keep folding back. So we fold back from age 99. Well, actually, we did the solutions all the way to age 40. I'm going to focus just on age 90. I think age 90 is kind of an interesting age, because we're able to basically to get to the point that here the investor started out with 90% of his assets in the company stock, and yet he sells down to 10% or less in the company stock. This is even though he's age 90, doesn't obviously have that much many more years to go, but the diversification is really important, much more important even than the impending reset of taxes. And frankly, this is something that we hadn't really appreciated before. I mean, we've always taken the view, I think, at least implicitly, that managing taxes are really important, and indeed they are. But here, what you see is that there's a real trade-off, and diversification is really important too, and in fact, it's sort of coming in this nonlinear way that I highlighted before. So how much company stock do you hold? Well, basically, you hold somewhere between 10% and zero. Obviously, you didn't have to pay any capital gains tax to sell the company stock. You'd want to hold zero, per my earlier discussion of our parameter choices, but basically never do you want to hold more than about 10% for these parameter choices. So you started out holding 90%, you sell it down to somewhere between 10% and zero, depending upon how much capital gains taxes you pay on the company stock. How much index do you buy? Well, you started out holding 10, and then it looks like you buy sort of somewhere in the 30 to 40% range, as depicted in this plot. So basically, you retain very little, not zero, but you retain very little of the company stock. How much you retain depends upon your tax basis in sort of the sensible way. Okay, so now I want to turn to my final numerical example, the case of a symmetric distribution. So now we've got two assets again. This time we give them the same mean and the same standard deviation as each other. So the only thing that's going to differ is actually going to be basically their bases. And the holdings, the incoming bases and holdings, but we're going to make the distribution look symmetric. And the point basically here is that what you do, this is sort of more like my Citigroup JP Morgan Chase example. So basically you retain more of the position with the larger gain. this cross effect, this cross basis effect or portfolio effect is actually pretty strong. For example, and let me just focus on the case of age 40. Let's say if it's costless to sell the assets, and the costless case would either correspond in these plots are really 180-degree rotations. These assets are the same, so the plots are actually effectively 180-degree rotations of each other. And in both cases, if I look at this corner, those involve holdings in each of the two assets of 22.4%. That's when basically it's free to adjust on both. So you hold the investor holds 22.4% of his wealth in each of the two assets, or about 45% in equity overall. On the other hand, if the basis price ratio of one of the assets is near zero, let's say 0.05, and on the other asset is one, so you can adjust on one but not the other, then your holdings are quite different. Then your respective holdings are 32.8 and 15% at the same age, at the same age 40. So you can see that it's not only there's an own effect, but there's a cross effect, and it's absorbing about half the difference, actually. I mean, it's, this cross effect, I think, is actually pretty strong. And what I think it's really bringing out is that when you think about what you want to do with respect to taxes and managing individual positions, it's important to understand the tax structure of the rest of what you hold. And another important point is that there's a considerable no-trade region, that is where you don't rebalance at all because of the tax costs. In holding space, I present a little plot of that. Now here, the way to interpret this plot is we've got these two assets, which are actually kind of symmetric. They are symmetric, actually, here, although I've called one index and one company, but they're really just assets A and B. And here what we're doing is we're varying the holdings of the two, and then we're looking at the what is the no-trade region. The no-trade region is basically the little diamond in the middle. Those are the regions where you don't trade, or basically otherwise you move to some edge of the diamond. That's basically the optimal policy in holding space. And we do the plot here for different basis to price ratios. The no-trade region is biggest, of course, when the tax costs are biggest. The no-trade region is pretty small if the basis to price ratios are pretty close to one, i.e. if the tax costs are pretty slight. And I think all of this is really quite intuitive. So that's basically a couple of numerical illustrations. Finally, I want to just briefly address the issue is there anything we can say in general? And in particular, here what I want to do is I want to just set up the problem a little bit more generally. So I made a lot of special assumptions to highlight, to be able to let me to get numerical solutions, but now I want to step back from that, and we'll just take a general case with J risky assets. We're going to now, for the general case, we can actually allow the capital gains liability to be determined by specific share identification rather than the average basis rule. We don't need the average basis rule now. We're going to allow, now we can allow labor income, and we can allow it to be correlated with asset returns. We can allow returns to be serially correlated itself. We don't necessarily need constant relative risk-averse preferences. Now, a couple of things that I do want for this. Allow investors to take losses if they have it. I want to assume away issues of trading costs, and I want to assume constant tax rates over time. The latter is actually going to be a bit important to some of the results I'm going to claim. So with those assumptions in mind, what are sort of the main features of the rebalancing solution, of in effect the solution to the portfolio problem? Well, basically there's a number of features. First, you realize if you have losses, you realize them. If you have different positions you can sell, you want to basically do what's called high basis first out. You want to sell the positions with either losses or the smallest gains, i.e. the highest bases, or that's why it's called high basis first out. By the way, these two features, realizing all losses and high basis first out, you might think, well, that's pretty obvious. Keep in mind that that's not a fully general result. In particular, remember I sort of slipped in this assumption about constant tax rates. Imagine that I didn't have constant tax rates, and more specifically, suppose the tax rates were going to grow a lot. Like, suppose I happened to be in a year. Suppose in the current year, I knew that my marginal tax rate on this stuff was going to be zero. If I knew my tax rate was going to be zero, I wouldn't want to realize losses. I want to let them carry forward in the sense that I don't want to book them this year because I'm not going to get any rebate. I would rather take them in the following year where I paid a positive tax. Similarly, I wouldn't want to file high basis first out, because if I was going to escape taxes anyway, high basis first out would be counterproductive. And the point basically is that if the tax rate is growing too, so I use zero taxes as an extreme, but the point basically is that the tax rates are growing too fast, these kind of conclusions won't attain. Now, I avoid all of that with the assumption of constant tax rates. Frankly, declining tax rates would be good too, or as long as the tax rates aren't rising too fast to offset the time value. Well, what are some of the other general features? Well, for a given amount of financial wealth, the investor is better off or effectively wealthier if his gains are smaller. Now, just to be clear about this, imagine you have two individuals and they both present balance sheets and you're trying to evaluate these individuals. Who's wealthier? They both present to you financial statements that sort of make it sound like they have $1 million in net worth. But one of the investors has got sort of small gains or no gains, and the other investor has got really big gains. So he's got a lot of embedded tax liability. He's effectively less wealthy. Now, he may not pay the tax, but still, it's going to constrain his strategy. And so he's effectively less wealthy in utility terms. We've talked a lot, of course, about the own basis effect, you have a greater ability to, you will adjust your position to a greater extent when your basis is relatively high, your gains are relatively small. We've talked about the cross-basis effect and how the basis of other assets comes into play in the opposite direction with respect to your holdings. And a final point that didn't really emerge, in part because I assumed average bases, so I couldn't really speak to this at all. But one other general observation is if you don't using the average basis rule, but you're using specific identification, you're better off as an investor if you've got a more dispersed distribution of gains. The reason for that is basically like a second-order stochastic dominance property. The reason for that is you can then cherry-pick these bases to a greater extent. You're effectively wealthier with a more dispersed distribution of gains because of then your ability to kind of to have more. You can play it off with the high basis first out rule. All right. Well, let me stop at this point. Unfortunately, I've sort of used up a lot of perhaps all the time. But I want to thank you very much.